topological field theory, dot, dot, dot. Yeah, as time goes on, I realize there might not be any dot, dot, dot. So, okay, so I'd like to continue with a discussion of kind of structural properties of topological field theory. I think there'll be a fair amount of overlap with what Sergey did, so hopefully that's good, not bad. See things from a slightly different point of view. So the last time we discussed this two-tier topological field theory, which was some machine that assigned n closed n manifolds, it assigned numbers, and it assigned n minus one manifolds, it assigned vector spaces, and had such that a gluing law held for how to decompose n-dimensional manifolds into open manifolds along a boundary. So I'll repeat that story in a second. I wanted to make one more structural property about this definition before we kind of enhance our notion of a topological field theory a little further. So, and these are the local operators that also appeared in Sergey's talk. So how do I want to think about operators in a field theory? So we discussed this in the case of gauge theory with finite group last time. But in any topological field theory, let's say we have an n-dimensional topological field theory, we're going to look at what it assigns to an n minus one sphere. So the n minus one sphere gets assigned a vector space. But the main property is that this vector space always has a vector structure. It's always an algebra. It's an algebra, and the type of algebra is going to be specified by the dimension. And the algebra structure is given by a kind of what a physicist or low-dimensional geometer would call a pair of pants, a topologist would call little disks. So we'll return to that a little bit later. So what's the kind of picture that we have in mind? Look at n equals 1, n equals 2, n equals 3, and so on. So if you have a one-dimensional field theory, then we're asking what you assign to the zero sphere, which is just a pair of points. So if you look at a pair of points, you could look at configurations of pairs of little intervals inside of a big interval. Maybe this picture is a little confusing until we see what am I trying to draw. In two dimensions, we draw the pair of pants, but we draw it from above like we did last time. So in two dimensions, you look at a pair of pants. In three dimensions, you look at three-dimensional pair of pants. So we're going to take the ball and cut out of it two smaller balls of the same dimension. And these diagrams give me an operation. From here, I get z of s2, tensor z of s2 to z of s2. I have two incoming small spheres and this a cobordism from them to a big sphere. That gives me a multiplication on them. The same thing here on z of s1 gets a multiplication. Here, z of s0 will similarly get a multiplication. And what kind of structure do we have on this multiplication? Well, this in two dimensions, we noticed last time that this operator algebra was commutative. So it's commutative because I can just move these points around each other, move, interchange them freely. If you go to three dimensions, it looks even more commutative. So we don't yet have a definition of a more commutative algebra, but we will next time. So let's say that this is a commutative algebra. This thing is a slightly more commutative algebra, but it's still commutative. And as you go up in dimension, you have kind of more and more room to move things around each other. That we're being a little too coarse in order to detect the difference. But if you think about little intervals here, then you can't move them around each other. Here you just get an associative algebra. So there's this kind of hierarchy. We're going to ignore kind of, this is a little too low dimension to be terribly useful. But there's going to be a distinction that there's kind of two kinds of algebras that appear, the ones that are associative and then there's commutative. Yeah? That's right. I mean, according to the definitions that I gave, if I have a one-parameter family of pairs of pants, That's That's right. So in this, if I give you a two-tier topological field theory in two dimensions, I won't get a mapping class group action. I'm going to see the mapping class group action later. That's because our definition of field theory is too weak. But with the structures that we've defined, we're looking at everything up to diffeomorphism. We don't have any room to see more. That's right. I just have a definition where I've given you. Maybe I'll answer that question in a minute when we do add another tier. But we're just going to, we're assigning a number to an N-manifold up to diffeomorphism. So diffeomorphic N-manifolds give you the same number. There's no ambiguity. N-1 manifolds, you get a vector space, which is now a functor. It's a functor of the N-1 manifolds. So you get some more structure there. But on the top manifolds, there is no extra structure because numbers don't have automorphisms. So if you would like to get a mapping class group action on the number assigned to a closed surface, but numbers don't have very interesting representations. So we're going to see how that gets more interesting in a second. I'm not considering the manifolds up to diffeomorphism. I have a functor. So I have a definition of a topological field theory. It's a functor from a category where the objects are N-1 manifolds. This is a category of N-1 manifolds. And the morphisms are going to be N-manifold cobordisms. These are cobordisms up to diffeomorphism. And I have a functor from this category to the category where I assign to the category of vector spaces. To an object, I assign a vector space. To here, I assign a number. And I haven't modded out by diffeomorphism here, so I can glue perfectly fine. So this is I guess I didn't write it this formally last time. This is the formal definition of a two-tier topological field theory. So it just doesn't have room. So yes, there is a mapping class group action on these numbers, if you were really, but it's trivial since it's a number. So we'll see how all of these issues in a second will get arbitrarily refined as time goes on. So let's. So the way I want to think about this algebra is it's the so these structures. This is a kind of topological OPE, topological operator product expansion. So if you'd like, instead of drawing my picture as these two disks as a pair of pants, I can think of this picture as having just I can make the disks very small. And so this is a multiplication where I have an operator sitting here and an operator sitting here. And then I look at it from far away, and I get just a single operator. That's another way to think of this operation. I have two operators, one here and one here. And then when I look at it from far away, I just see I'm so far away that I only see a single disk. And this is the operator product expansion. I have an operator here and an operator here, and they're coming together, and I'm getting a new operator. Just in topological field theory, this OPE is not a very rich structure yet. Now, why am I calling these operators? This is just what I assign to the sphere. So you can ask, what does this have to do with, what does it act on? And, well, it acts on something natural. So the claim is, again, in any topological field theory, this algebra of assigned to the N-1 sphere, it acts on the vector space I assign to any closed N-1 manifold. And what's this action? Well, I take my N-1 manifold, and I let some time evolve. So I look at my N-1 manifold across the interval. And now I'm going to pick a point x in my N-1 manifold. And this action a priori could depend on this x, but we'll see it doesn't. So I pick my point x. And then, let's say at half time, I cut out a little ball around this point. So I have a point x cross a half. And so now what is this diagram? This is exactly the diagram that tells me that I have a map from, that I have an incoming N-1 sphere, an incoming n, and an outgoing n. So I get an operator. And so we have an action of this algebra. Now if you move x to a different point, y, you'll get isomorphic operators. So again, later we'll see more refined versions where the locations will matter. But in this kind of naive level, you just get a single operator that for n different x's, you get isomorphic maps. So the point is that these, so if I think of my field theory, here's kind of the space of states on N. The space of states on N carries an action of this algebra of local operators, these point operators. So that's maybe to write it the way, in more physics terminology, the way the same thing appeared in Sergei's talk. Again, as a caricature, you write an operator in here, then I can look at a path integral where I write d phi and my e to the minus s of phi, but now I insert operator at time x, at point x and time t of phi. So I make some measurement of phi at, well, I happen to do it at time 1/2. Again, it won't matter what time I do it at. And this is my expectation value of the operator O at this point at this time. So this is the expectation values. You can also similarly define operators. So anyway, these are the same operators that appeared. We can also, maybe another thing to point out, we can also do other labelings. So what do I mean by other labelings? So for example, suppose I'm in a three-dimensional topological field theory. This is supposed to be some three-manifold. And I give you, I don't really know how to draw a knot. So I don't know, that's some probably a knot, but oh well. Anyway, so suppose I give you a loop in this three-manifold. How do I define operators or labelings? Well, again, I take the tubular neighborhood. I cut out in this formalism that we did. I take the tubular neighborhood of this and cut it out. And now what do I have? I have the boundary of the tubular neighborhood is isomorphic now to S1 cross S1, or in general, Sn minus 2, if I have a loop in a N manifold. So I have this boundary of the tubular neighborhood. And so if you give me any vector V in the space assigned to S1 cross Sn minus 2, I can then think of labeling this loop by V. So I can construct an operator. So if I have a closed manifold other than this loop, I'll now get a new number, a number assigned to each label. Or if this manifold had some other boundary, I'll get some operators. So this way you can construct the kind of loop operators that appeared in Sergei's talk in this formalism. They're just labeled in the space of states on the boundary of a tubular neighborhood. That's what labels the possible operators. And again, there's, as appeared in Sergei's talk, there are two different kinds of operators that might appear in quantum field theory, but they're both included naturally in this formalism. There's what you might call order and disorder operators. And they're both given by the same kind of formalism. So the point is that my operators here, so my operators can come in two forms. Operators can be measurements, like in this picture up here. They could be like some measurement of my field at a particular point. So that's the kind of operator. That's, for example, the Wilson loop operators appear in this form. You're taking your field on the loop and you're measuring it, or you're measuring its holonomy. But they could also be, so remember that our operators are labeled by what are operators in my formalism. We think of them as functionals on boundary values of fields. So I have fields on this boundary of this tubular neighborhood, and I have functionals on those things. So, or they can be given by functionals on boundary values of fields that are supported on fields with a given singularity, with a given singularity type. So maybe I don't, at my fields, no one is telling me my field actually extends inside of this tube. I can only look at measurements that only detect fields that have a particular kind of singularity along this tube. And these are the kind of Etoft operators. And of course, you can take various combinations. So the point is that this formalism is sort of tells you any kind of operator. They're all labeled by the states on this punctured tubular neighborhood. Okay. So now, are there questions? All right, so now I'd like to make my topological field theory a little richer. And to do that, I'm going to add another tier. So I'm going to add another tier. I'm going to look at three-tiered topological field theory. And this is where we're going to make more contact with the subject of the other lectures and see things like D-brains. So what does it mean to do another tier? Now let's remember, why did we introduce N-1 manifolds? We introduced N-1 manifolds because we wanted to express the locality of the path integral with respect to cut and paste. We wanted to say the number associated to a manifold can be described by local pieces, by a gluing rule. But now we believe that things were really local. They're still local. So what we want to do, so now we're going to go to three tiers, or more generally, there's a notion of extended topological field theory. And I'm going to kind of consistently drop extended. So I want to express the idea is the same idea as before. I want to express locality of the vector space. Now, before I had locality of numbers, now I want to express locality of the vector space Z of n with respect to cut and paste. So I have this N-1 manifold. I can still think of decomposing it. So what's my rule? I write down the same formula we wrote last time. So if n is given as N1 union N2 over a common boundary, so we even draw the same picture. But now remember that we're one dimension lower. We have our manifold is glued from two pieces along a common boundary, and Y is now an N-2 manifold. Then we want to give the formula that Z of N should be calculated as take Z of the left half and take Z of the right half and glue them together, pair them in the context given by their shared boundary. The boundary will tell you a place in which to glue these. So this is exactly what we did last time. So all we have to do is we have to interpret this formula. We have to figure out how are you going to be able to interpret this formula. How do you get a vector space as a pairing for two things somewhere? So where's the somewhere where you can pair things in it to get a vector space? And there's a natural guess. So a natural guess is we take Z of Y should be a linear category. So what's a linear category? Well, it's a category where the Hongs are vector spaces. I'm doing everything over C. It's a C linear category. So we have a bunch of objects of my category. And for any two objects, I have the Hong is now a C vector space. So that's kind of a context where you might imagine getting vector spaces out of pairings. So the idea is that I'm going to take Z of n. My rule is now going to be that Z of n should be an object of the category Z of delta n, where n is now, suppose, a manifold with boundary. You should now assign to it, before we had a vector in the vector space associated to the boundary, now we give an object in the category associated to the boundary. So it's the same rule. Before I write this more formally, let me give a more physical motivation for this. Why would you think to do this from the notion of studying the path integral? And again, let's think. Why did we get vector spaces? How did we think we should assign a vector space to an N-1 manifold? If you had an N manifold with boundary, we needed to fix boundary values on N, on the boundary. Once you fix the boundary values, you can kind of think that M was a closed manifold, and it should be assigned a number. To make the path integral on N defined, you have to fix some boundary conditions, and then you get a number. And so what you got was this gives you directly a C-valued function on the space of boundary values of fields. You fix a boundary value field, do the path integral, you get a number. So what do we want to do now? We want to do the exact same thing. And so that's how we got that to an N-1 manifold. We want to do something like functions on the space of boundary values. Functions form a vector space. That's why we assigned a vector space. So we do the same thing here. We just call them different letters. You write an N, and you write a Y. And again, you think, if I fix the boundary values on Y, this should function like a closed n minus 1 manifold. That means I should be able to assign to it a vector space in my formalism. So if I just open n is not a well-defined thing. I can't assign to it a vector space. But if I fix boundary values in y, I should get a vector space, which means that every time I fix boundary values in y, I get a vector space, which means I get a vector bundle, or maybe more generally a sheaf of vector spaces. I get a bunch of vector spaces on the space of boundary values. So in other words, if you look on fields on y, each time you fix a boundary value for a field on y, you get something which you can now assign a vector space to. So in other words, what we should be considering, instead of functions on the space of fields, we should be looking at bundles on the space of fields. Or more generally, some kind of jumping collections of vector space, which are sheaves. So that means that z of y, morally, should be some kind of sheaves, or families of vector spaces, on fields of y. This is going to be our caricature, just like z of n was functions on fields on n. And so, but the main structure, so this is a caricature. The main point about this is that this is not a vector space, but it's naturally a C-linear category. That's the structure this thing has. So this is one way to motivate why we'd like to think of assigning a category. So we take the same space. We know that we should look at the space of fields on y. We need to linearize it, quantize it, but we need to get a category out of it rather than a vector space. OK, so let me now give a slightly more formal definition of an extended field theory. Well, morally, if I've identified the boundary, so slightly more, it's a little more, if you look at the boundary of N1 and the boundary of N2, they're actually going to be opposite orientation manifolds. So they actually don't live in, these guys don't live in the same category, just like before, they didn't live in the same vector space. Really, one lived in one vector space, one lived in the dual vector space, and that's where you had a canonical pairing. It's opposite category. Well, it's not the opposite category, it's the dual category. It's a category of functionals to vector spaces. So I'll write this down in the axioms. But if you reverse orientations, you should get the dual category, which is maps to vect. But in the kind of situations that appear, like in two-dimensional field theory, you're going to be able to identify this category and its opposite. So this really will just be a Hom pairing within the same category. Yeah, in typical examples, these most categories that you run into actually are self-dual in a natural way. So let me, I don't want to spend much time on axiomatics, but let me just give the kind of flavor of the definition. So the definition is we construct a two-category. So I don't want to say what a two-category is, but it's something that has the following flavor. It's going to have objects. So it looks like, starts out looking like a category, and its objects are going to be n minus 2 manifolds. Folds y. And since we like two-dimensional field theory, I'll just draw them as points. So these are our objects. Now, between each object, we have a notion of morphism. And to be pedantic, we call them one morphism. And one morphism will be n minus one-dimensional manifolds with boundary, which are cobordisms. So this is the same thing we had before. We have given two zero manifolds, we look at cobordisms on them. But the trick is, and this is to answer the question, this is now I'm not identifying them up to diffeomorphism. These one morphisms now are, I'm not thinking about them up to diffeomorphism, I'm just thinking about them as a category of a notion of maps between n minus one manifolds, and I'll keep that notion here. And now that enables me to go one level further, and I'm allowed to connect two such things. So now I'm going to look at n manifolds. So I'm just stacking up all the structure we have had. N manifolds, now they are going to have corners also. And there are going to be cobordisms between cobordisms. Let's just call them metacobordisms. So given two cobordisms, you can think of filling it in, finding a cobordism between those two, which is now a two-manifold with corners. Everything is smooth oriented, yes, consistently. Yeah. Okay, so what's a topological? So this is the structure of cut and paste when I'm allowed to go down to two dimensions. This is the kind of structure I'm allowed to do when I cut and paste. And what's a topological field theory? Well, let me notice also that there's an operation of disjoint union, which is, oh, thank you very much. And this is optodiffial. That's very important. That's right. So I just want to think of these optodiffeomorphisms. And my N-manifolds haven't gotten any more interesting. I'm just going down. So my, right. So if I have closed N-manifolds, they're just the same that they've always been. So, and then there's an operation of disjoint union on all of these things. What's a topological field theory? Just like before, it's a multiplicative functor. So that's what it's always been. Now it goes from here to somewhere. To some target two category. Okay, so you can start thinking about lots of topological field theories valid in lots of things, but let's not get too abstract. You could just say, the place I want to go is I want to assign, well, maybe I should start from the bottom. We already know what our two morphisms, well, okay, maybe that's a bad idea. All right, so where should we go? I've already told you what we want to do. We want to assign to a point, or to a codimension two, we want to assign a linear category. Given two categories, you can look at functors between them. And given functors, you have natural transformations between those. So this is, we're already used to draw them by pictures like this, right? Except that we usually draw this one like that. If you have two functors, you have a notion of natural transformation between them. So we just want to match the pictures to the algebra. So that's what a topological field theory is. And it's supposed to be multiplicative, and I don't want to kind of spell out too much axiomatics. So I want to work out some examples of these things and see what kind of structure this gives us. I should probably mention some names. I learned these kind of things from Dan Fried. I'm not sure when people started thinking about going down further and further in this axiomatic framework. Baez and Dolan formulated some very general conjectures along them, and they've mostly been proven now by Hopkins and Lurie. So I'll say more about this when I get to specifics, but let me just kind of say the philosophy that maybe goes back to Siegel. The philosophy is that somehow, if you like, that the points are boring. And so the idea is that two manifolds are interesting. Two manifolds can have lots of interesting structures. One manifold, okay, the circle still has some topology. Points are really boring. So if we have a cut and paste rule that enables us to go down to the level of points, you might hope that the whole structure of a field theory is really recovered in a simple way. You take your two manifold, and rather than just being cutting and pasting into pairs of pants, I might try, say, even triangulating it or decomposing it into some piece. Eventually, I'll just get down to some information on the level of points. If I have good gluing laws, I should be able to recover everything by what I do to a point. And so the idea is that if you really go down all the way to a point, you're left with only algebra. All the topology disappears. So somehow, and this is now a theorem of Hopkins and Lurie, and I'll state it more precisely later on. So you can, if you're feeling like generalization, you can now think of what it means to have a four-tier topological field theory or a five-tier. Just keep stacking this thing up. And the main thing is not how many tiers you have, but the main thing is we're luckier if we can get down to a point, because things will be easy. And luckily, when we're doing two-dimensional field theory, that's not so far to go. So let's do something more concrete. So let's go back to gauge theory. Are there questions about this general? Points are not different. Points, a point is a point. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But of course, you can cut it up further if you wanted, so you don't need. Let's talk about the example of topological gauge theory. So again, I'm going to study 2D gauge theory, but I'm going to make my life very easy, or maybe possible, by having the group be finite, so we can work out everything we want. So now, we work out what to assign to a surface and to the circle before. What should we assign to a point? Well, we already know what we should do. Our category, z of a point, we have a general prescription. It should be some kind of vector bundles. Everything's going to be nice enough that we don't have to think what a sheaf is. We have vector bundles on the space of gauge fields, just fields on y, which is a point. They look at fields on a point. So you look at all your fields on the point, and the way we're going to linearize this is by looking at vector bundles on them. That's our general rule. Okay. So what is this thing? What are gauge fields on a point? Well, again, what do I mean by gauge fields? Remember that in our theory, fields, this means G bundles, or flat G bundles, or G covering spaces. We have lots of ways of thinking about it because G is finite. But now, what are G bundles on a point? Well, here we want to be a little careful. We're going to think of this not as a set, but as an orbifold. We're just going to think of it just like before last time, we ignored the fact that when you count things, you have to count them with multiplicities when things have automorphisms. So we little loose with that last time. This time we're not going to be able to get loose, to be loose with this. We're looking at this thing is going to be vector bundles on point. Well, there's only a single G bundle on a point. There's only one way to put G over a point, but it has automorphisms G. There's a single object, but it has many, many automorphisms. It's a trivial bundle and has G worth of automorphism. So this thing, there are lots of ways to draw it. It's a kind of an orbifold with a single point and a group G of symmetries. A homotopy theorist would call it BG. A stacky person, or I don't know, various people would write it as point mod G. There are lots of notations for this. But that's the thing. That's the thing we're looking at. We're looking at vector bundles on the space of fields, point mod G. Okay. Now, what's a vector bundle on an orbifold? Well, we have only a point. There's only one point. So a vector bundle on a point is a vector space. Okay, fine. So it's a vector space. But this point has symmetries. So every time you see a symmetry of this point, it has to be reflected on the vector space. A vector bundle on this point mod G, or another way to say it, it's a G-equivariant vector bundle on a point. It means that it's a vector space on which G is acting. The symmetries of the point have to act. And these are exactly representations, or complex representations of G. So we have a linear category. It's a category of representations of G. Okay. Let's write it in a way that's closer to what we said last time. What is the linear representation of a group? To write a group acting, you might as well linearize it and say the actual group algebra is acting. Group algebra is an algebra that's generated by elements corresponding to the group, and you just allow them to scale them by complex numbers. So if a group acts on a vector space, this algebra, this non-commutative Frobenius algebra that we studied last time, acts. So our category is modules over this non-commutative Frobenius algebra. We're going to study this a little more, but this at least tells us what we should do, what we should assign. Now we need to make sure that you can assign all the operations. Remember that we have to assign operations for one manifold with boundary. Now, how do we do that? We have this very general prescription. You look at fields given a cobordism, you think of it as a correspondence. It goes from fields on one cobordism from y1 to y2. The space of fields, you can restrict to y1, you can restrict to y2. This is when this is n, this is y1 and y2. Now, what did we do before? We took a function on fields, we pulled it back, and we pushed it forward. That was our operations. You can do the same thing with vector bundles. Given a vector bundle and a map, you can do the same thing. So if you have vector bundles on y1, you can pull them back. You get a vector bundle on fields. This is vector bundle on, let me just call it f of y1. This is f of n. Okay, you can pull back vector bundles. But all our maps are finite. You can actually also push forward. You can just sum up along the fibers. So if you have a finite map, a map of finite sets, you could just take the sum of all the fibers, and you get a vector bundle downstairs. So vector bundles you can push forward for finite maps, and you get a vector bundle on fields on Y2. So this prescription tells you if you're dealing only with these kind of finite sets, we can use exactly the same prescriptions to build our topological field theories down to a point. I'm going to work this out explicitly in our case, but let's do a little detour. I'll work out and say exactly what happens in the case of gauge 3, what structure this gives. But let's do, so what I'd like to work out, this, so what I'm explaining now was this topological field theories, two-dimensional field theories down to a point, in the case where everything is semi-simple, the kind of setting I'm working out now was worked out by Moore and Siegel. They drew slightly different pictures than the one I'm going to draw, but it's the exact same story. This is called open, closed 2D TFTs. Their perspective was slightly different. They actually derived the category structure out of the pictures rather than axiomatizing it the way I am. But let's just see in general, what kind of structure do you have? So suppose I give you V and W are two objects of my category, two representations of G. And actually, the pictures I'm going to draw are going to be general. They could be for any of these categories, but let's write this for concreteness. So given two such, given two representations, what can you do? You can look at maps between them. Or in the topological field theory picture, suppose I have V is in my category associated to a point, W is in my category associated to a point. I can look at this cobordism. Cobordism from two points to the empty set. So to the empty set, I'm required to assign the complex, the empty set. So what do I assign to the empty set? I assign just vector spaces, the category of vector spaces. So this is going to be Z of the empty zero manifold. This is, again, something that's required by multiplicativity. So given two representations, I'm required to assign to them a vector space. How do you assign a vector space to two representations? Well, it's just HOM. You look at HOM from V to W, maps of representations, the maps in my category. So this picture tells me that given two representations, I should get a vector space, which is just the HOM in the category. What other things can I do? Well, I can draw pictures that appeared in Paul's talk the other day. I can draw, suppose I give you three representations or four representations, I can draw pictures like this. Given three representations, I have a picture like this. Now, what is this picture going to tell me? This picture is telling me that if I go from HOM from U to V, if I have a map from U to V and a map from V to W, I get a map from U to W. Is everyone following my kind of the calculus of pictures here? I have, this is HOM UV, this is HOM VW, this edge is HOM UW, but I have a surface filled in. That means a natural transformation between the functor of HOM tensor HOM to HOM. Multiplicativity, again. So this is going to be part of my rule of how, if I take a union like this, I'm going to have to. Or if you'd like, I really can take U, V, and VW disjointly, and then I'm going to be contracting here on the middle entry. So really, you have HOM UV and HOM V prime W, and then there's a contraction. In the pictures that Moore and Siegel drew, they would put in here a little different kind of boundary. They would have two kinds of boundary to fill in where you don't know what's going on in this kind of picture. So let me just take that as the rules of the game rather than. So I have this map, and what is this map? This is just composition. So this picture tells me just the category structure. It's just the composition of maps. And another thing I can say is that if I look at V, I can draw a picture like this. I'm not going to fill it in. I'm just looking at pictures of these, and I'm thinking this picture is going to represent for me HOM V V. And that's an associative algebra. So this is just a structure of being a category. So maybe I'll stop drawing these pictures. So what I want to say is, what's special about this category? So far we just had a category, but there's something special about it. And the thing that's special about it is that CG is a Frobenius algebra. It has a non-degenerate trace. So you can ask, what does that have to do with anything? What does it mean to have modules over an algebra with non-degenerate trace? And this is going to be something, again, that we're going to be able to see diagrammatically. So the modules over, last time we had commutative algebras. This time we have a non-commutative Frobenius algebra, but we can look at modules over them. And they form a very special kind of category. They form what's called a Calabi-Yau category. One would like to call them Frobenius, but the name was already taken. So we'll explain where the name Calabi-Yau comes from here. But the point is going to be that I'm going to think of them as vector bundles on a zero-dimensional Calabi-Yau for now. So my discrete sets of points were actually secretly Calabi-Yaus, but everything was dimension zero, so you couldn't really tell. So what does it mean to be a Calabi-Yau category? It means that for every V, if you look at endomorphisms of V, well, endomorphisms of an object is always an algebra. You can always compose self-maps, but this is actually a Frobenius algebra. It's a Frobenius algebra, which means it has a non-degenerate trace. There's a non-degenerate trace. So what is this doing pictorially? So this is a special kind of category. It's a category where the endomorphisms of everything have traces, and there's some compatibilities between them. So what, where did I get this from? I can get this pictorially by saying, I'm going to, let me draw this picture. So the way I'm going to draw it is I'm going to say, here's my V. I'm going to look at endomorphisms of V. Endomorphism of V is a vector space I assigned to this closed loop that begins and ends in V. Now I want to get a trace. What's a trace? I need to get a map from this vector space to C. Well, I'm just going to fill in the disk. Let me write this slightly more. Let me spread it out a little so we can see what's going on. You take endomorphisms of V, and then I'm going to draw a cylinder where this is just a plain old boring circle with no marked points, and then I'll cap it off. So I'm going to draw a picture like this. So I haven't really told you what the rules of my picture drawing are. So let's just take it that these are all allowable pictures. But what is this telling me? This is telling me that I have a map from endomorphisms of V to Z of S1 to C. Well, I have there's a trace. But in fact, the trace factors through Z of S1. Here I have end V. Here I had a circle. So I get this vector space Z of S1. And here I have nothing, so I have the complex numbers. So I have a trace, but not just a trace that goes through my commutative Frobenius algebra. OK, this is very confusing, probably, maybe. But let's draw the picture in the opposite direction for a second. That'll tell us. That's something maybe more familiar. And then I'll tell you, I'll tell you what it is in my example, of representation theory. So let's draw the picture in the other direction. Well, this picture, we already knew what it meant. There's a map from C to Z of S1. Remember, in my examples, Z of S1 is the center, is class functions, which is the center. Is the center of the group algebra. OK, there's a map, and that was my unit. That's the unit for this algebra. Okay, but now I'm adding onto that a cylinder. So I'm just drawing the exact same picture, but I'm drawing it in the opposite direction. So this tells me that Z of S1 maps to end of V, which here is the endomorphisms of my representation. So what is this telling me? So V here is my example is a representation of the group G or of its group algebra. What is this saying? Well, it's telling me if you take the endomorphism of representation, first of all, there's a canonical endomorphism of any representation, namely one. Don't do anything. But not only is there a canonical endomorphism, every representation carries an action of this mysterious guy as endomorphisms. Well, what is that? If I have a representation of the group, the center of the group algebra will act on it, commuting with the action of the group. So this is just the action of the center of the group algebra on my representation. Now, what is this mysterious map up there? What is this trace in the case of gauge theory? Well, again, it's something very familiar. What is it going to be? Well, let's make life a little easier. My representations are not so mysterious. We're dealing with a finite group. So let's write V as a direct sum of irreducible representations, each one taken a bunch of times. So here, Vi are going to be irreducible, and each one is going to be taken with some multiplicity. So just a bunch of copies. Okay? So if you write a representation this way, what are its endomorphisms? Well, Schur's lemma tells you that endomorphisms, if you have an irreducible representation, it just has scalars as endomorphisms. So endomorphisms of V is not such a mysterious thing. It's just a bunch of matrix algebras. So it's just a direct sum of the algebras of Ni by Ni matrices. Each of these factors, all I can do is act on this side. Okay. Now, what am I saying? I'm saying that this algebra has a trace. What is this trace? Well, in particular, let's just think of the identity matrix. Where is that trace going to go? I need to send this to some element of the group algebra. So what is this mysterious operation? You're taking an irreducible representation, Vi, and you're assigning it a trace which lives in the center of the group algebra, which is a class function. How do you assign a class function to a representation? You take its character, character of Vi. So this is what I've been doing up till now is a very complicated way of saying, or if you'd like the rest of the trace, if you look at n by n matrices, we take the usual trace, the scalars, and then one in scalars goes to the character. So I've actually described the whole map. So if you look at representations of a finite group, there's a natural canonical trace on endomorphism of any representation, and not just a boring old trace. You can assign a class function to any representation. This is exactly the notion of character. So in other words, the structure of a topological field theory of this Calabi-Yau category, of this category with traces, is exactly encoding representation theory of finite groups. It's telling me, to a point, it's assigning the category of representations, and it knows about how the class functions act on every representation, and it knows characters. Okay. All right, so in general, in this context, the theorem of Moore and Siegel in the kind of context I'm dealing with now, and Costolo in a slightly more refined context that I'll get to next time, says that in a 2D topological field theory, Z of the point is a Calabi-Yau category. It's a category with traces. But that means that for every object, it has a canonical character, which lives in Z of S1. And Z of S1, moreover, is the center. There's a notion of center for a category, which is known, which are technical definitions, endomorphisms of the identity functor on the category, or this is also known as Hochschild cohomology. So, no, if you, I'm being a little vague about the exact axiom, but if you set up the full strength of the axioms, it actually is the center. So that's, I'll state the more precise version of Hopkins-Lurie next time. But, so the Z of S1 actually is the center, and you have this notion of characters. Okay. This is the structure. So the structure of this two-dimensional topological field theory exactly captures, in this case, representation theory of finite groups. Let me briefly do one more example which is really going to be a variant on the same example, but in with different language. So let me think. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's well, that's what this means, that Z of S1 acts compatibly on every object. It's kind of it's a linear the category is linear not just over C, it's linear over this algebra. Yeah. It's linear over it. I don't know what commutative means. I think this is the sentence, which means that the category is linear over this center. So this category is what we are going to call dbrands. And before I can allow to call them dbrands, I might want them to look a little more like dbrands. So let me just do another example. And my example is now going to be a sigma model, except that I'm incredibly constrained in what I'm allowed to say because I only have finite sets that I'm allowed to work in. So it's going to be a sigma model on a finite set. Well, that's a little boring, so let me do a finite orbifold. So we're going to have my space X is going to be a disjoint union of points with some symmetries HI. So of course, it's actually going to be just a bunch of copies of what I did before. But I want to think of it as a sigma model. So a sigma model means what? It means that my fields are maps. So it means that fields on any y or n or m are just going to be maps. My space of field are maps from y to x. That's the prescription. Everything's finite. I don't really need to be too careful about what kind of sigma model. So now let's just work out what does this. So we now have a full prescription of what this does. And so what do we get? So if you have a closed surface, so I'm going to do a two-dimensional sigma model, Z of sigma. Is what? Well, it's the number. To get a number, you have to count the number of maps from sigma to x. You look at maps from sigma to x, and you need to count them. That's going to be my partition function. Well, what is that? That's just the sum over I. These maps have to land in one of the points. And then, well, I have the same thing I had before. I had point mod hi. A map to point mod hi is just an h bundle. So this is the number of HI bundles on sigma of isomorphism. So that's counting. What is Z of the circle? Well, Z of the circle, again, general prescription. It's functions on maps from S1 to X, in other words, the free loop space of X. Free loop space here is not terribly exciting. What's the free loop space of a point with symmetries? Well, the free loop space of a point with symmetries, if you map a circle into this orbifold, the only thing it has to do is wrap around the symmetries. What's a map from, well, a map from a circle to a finite set is boring. It has to go to one of the points. But I have a finite orbifold, so my circle is around to kind of wrap around a symmetry. So this space of maps is actually the union of hi mod hi. Or if you'd like, I can just think of it as a gauge theory. These are gauge fields, HI gauge fields on the circle. That's the same calculation we had in the gauge theory setting. So this is just the direct sum over I of functions, of class functions on HI. Or if you'd like, in the notation before, it's the you'd look at the group algebra of HI and you look at the class functions. Okay. Of course, it's the same thing we had before. And now, finally, what is Z of a point? This is vector bundles on the space of maps. So hopefully, this is seeming a little more like dbrands, at least by saying vector bundles on the, well, on the space of maps from point to x. Well, maps from point to x is just x. So my category is a category of vector bundles on the space on the target. And so this is just the same thing. It's direct sum of representations of HI. And then you can ask, what is this character map, this mysterious map? Well, it's basically the churn character. If you have a vector bundle on a space, you can calculate its churn character. Except that in this case, the churn character is not a very interesting thing. It'll be just, if there were no orbit folding at all, there's nothing to calculate. If it is orbit folding, it'll be just the character of the group. So in general, in this kind of sigma model picture, that character map will be calculate the churn character of your vector bundle. So I guess I'm supposed to draw a kind of stringy picture where I think of this is my D-brain. So here's my ambient space X. Of course, X was a finite set, but that's OK. And so I have my sheaf V, which is supported on here. And then I can look at endomorphisms of V. These are my open string states that begin and end on V. Z of S1, that's the closed string states. That's what happens assigned to the circle. And the maps that I was considering are just these kind of open closed string transitions. An open string can attach or detach from this. So those are the two maps we were considering. Oh my. OK. Other questions? OK. So that was saying something about the structure of extended field theory. While we're in extended field theory, what else can we do? We could do the same kind of games we played before. So now let me look at what are the local operators. So before we had local operators in just a two-tier theory. But now I can have local operators that are more interesting. So now, in any three-tier or extended TFT, I can now consider the next level of operator. So before I looked at the n minus 1 sphere, and that gave me my local operators on vector spaces. But now I can go one level down. Z of the n minus 2 sphere is now an algebra. Well, but it's a category, right? So it's a category with multiplication. So this has a name. It's called monoidal category. It just means it's a category with multiplication. But I'm going to ignore the difference between categories and vector spaces to an extent. So where does this come from? It's again, I just draw the same pictures. If I have pairs of points, I look at the zero sphere. I have a way of taking this pair of points and this pair of points and constructing a new pair of points. So I have a cobordism between these. And this will give me an associative. So in n equals 0, I'll just get an associative multiplication. In n equals, I guess that's n equals 2. Yeah, the zero sphere will have an associative multiplication. Now here, if I look at the one sphere, I look at z of S1, it again has a multiplication given by this picture. Z of S2 has a multiplication. The multiplications are given by the exact same pictures we had before, but now they're multiplications on categories rather than on vector spaces. And now remember what happened before. We had only two possibilities. We had either associative in this dimension and commutative everywhere else. But once we go to categories, something more interesting happens. We now have three different options, three different possibilities. So if you think of the category you assign to a two-sphere, you really get an honest commutative multiplication. This is what's called a symmetric. It's a symmetric monoidal or tensor. Maybe let's call it tensor category. This is really commutative multiplication. You can take the two spheres. You have something in this category, something in this category. You multiply them, you get something in the outside category. And it doesn't matter which order you do them. You move them around, you get a well-defined commutative multiplication. But in this case, there's something more subtle, which is you can move the two things around each other. And this gives me a braiding. So in this case, I get a braided tensor category. Why do I get it? What's happened? Why do I get a braided tensor category? Like, why did things get more interesting? Well, I still have, just like before. Before, I had A times B equals B times A. That's why I got commutative. Here, I still have V tensor W equals W tensor V in some sense, but they're objects of a category. When you define single level of category, you never say equal. You say is isomorphic to. So the same picture that told you before things were commutative tells you that things are now, you still have an isomorphism from V tensor V to W to V tensor W to W tensor V. The problem is what happens when you go around twice. You now have an isomorphism. That isomorphism doesn't need to square to the identity. It's just you have an isomorphism. It's not just two numbers are equal. You do have a structure of a braiding. If you start now composing a whole bunch of copies, you'll find that the multiplication depends only on the corresponding braid. If you try to move these guys around each other in some particular way, you can draw that as some kind of braid. And the multiplication you get will only depend on the corresponding braid. But it will depend, but there is still a more interesting structure. So we've seen that the multiplication on the local operators now splits into three different types. And as you can imagine, when we get more and more complicated, there'll be more and more and more distinctions. So here, once you go to the two-sphere, there's no more room for things to be interesting. If you go two-sphere or higher, it's just purely commutative. And then the final thing I wanted to say about this is the same pictures again say that we have an action. Not just a category, but if you look at Z of Y, any n minus 2 manifold, again, it gets a action of this category, Z of the n minus 2 sphere. Again, I draw the same pictures, and I get an action of this category depending on a choice of a point. Okay. So this is the picture of local operators one dimension down. So I guess I'm out of time. So next time I'm going to explain how, by looking at this, we get the basic structure of geometric Langevin. When we apply this to just this axioms in the case of the four-dimensional field theory, you'll see the basic pattern of geometric Langevin coming up. Okay, thanks.
So the
affine Hecke algebra is not going to be braided. It's just going to be the category that Sergey will have will just be associative. So in his picture is going to be, it's going to be going down one dimension lower. It's going to be you have a four-dimensional field theory, topological field theory, and you're going to fix. So just like before, in a two-dimensional field theory, if I picked an object of the category. So in a two-dimensional field theory, I picked an object of this category, associative point, and I got an algebra, which is its endomorphisms. So in the way what's going to happen in Sergey's picture is you have this four-dimensional field theory. You're going to have something associated to the circle. And this is going to label surface operators. So the surface operators in this four-dimensional field theory are labeled by Z of the circle. Now, unfortunately, that's three down. So this will be a two category. But he's going to take a particular surface operator, I don't know what you call it, take a particular surface operator, and now look at its endomorphisms. And this is the algebra of line operators on this surface operator S. And again, it's just endomorphisms of an object of two category, whatever, but it still just has no reason to be commutative or braided or anything.